Hello, everybody. This following podcast is taken from a lecture that was given for the Irish History and Culture course at UCC Language Centre. So it's all about Gaelic games and the Irish cultural revival. And if you're interested in finding out more about the course, you can follow the link in the show notes. Enjoy the programme.
Okay, so anyway, guys, the two sports that we're going to be talking about, first of all, you have on the left-hand side here, the one with the stick and the ball, right? The name of the game in English is hurling. And the name of the game in Irish is imáinéacht. That is the first game. Then the stick, right? In English, we call it a hurley, H-U-R-L-E-Y. And then the little kind of leather ball that you see down here is called a slitzer, right? S-L-I-O-T-A-R. Okay. And then the other sport represented by the ball is Gaelic football. Okay, we call it Pell in Irish, P-E-I-L. Okay, so where do these games come from? How old are these games? Well, hurling and Gaelic football, or sometimes we just refer to it as Gaelic, these games have been played in Ireland for centuries, probably for even millennia. Because you may have heard of Julius Caesar. So Julius Caesar, the important historical figure in ancient Rome. So during his lifetime, he wrote a book called Commentarii, where he wrote about his experiences of conquering Gallia. Right now, Gallia, or Gaul, as we call it in English, is a place that used to be in Western Europe, in the territory which is now occupied by France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and a little bit of Western Germany, and maybe North Western Italy. Okay, so that so he conquered that area for Rome and made a part of the Roman Empire. But during his campaign there, he wrote about some of the local customs, wrote about some of the aspects of the culture of the local people. Now, the people that were living in Gaul, they were Celtic as well, right? So just like the Irish, they were Celtic too. Now, just looking at the word Celtic and Gaelic, right? What's the difference between the two of these? Well, Celtic or Celtoi is the word that the Greeks had for the Celts. Okay, so that's where the word Celts comes from, Celtoi. There's a few different theories about what it means, but my favorite theory is that it means the hidden people, right? It means the hidden people in the Celtic language. And that's very likely where the Greeks came up with the word Celtoi. Because in modern day Irish, in the modern day Irish language, we refer to Celts as na Celtic. So Celtoi, K-E-L-T-O-I, and na Celtic, you know, it's not a massive difference. So that's likely to be where the Greeks got the name from. And then the Roman word for the Celts was the Gauls, okay? Or the Gallia. Gallia was what they called that province that was conquered by Caesar, where the Celts lived, as I was saying, in the territory occupied by modern-day France, Holland, Belgium, and Western Germany, okay? So So it's kind of that was a romanization, let's say, of the word Celt. So Celt, Gelt, Celtic, Gaelic, these words all come from the same source. So the Romans heard Celtoi from the Greeks, and then they kind of came up with their own word, their own Latinized version of that word. Okay, so basically, Celtic and Gaelic or Gallic, right? They all come from the same source. They all refer to the same people. Now, who were the Celts? Well, they weren't a single ethnic group, right? They weren't a single kind of nation, let's say, like the Japanese are today, or like let's say, the Welsh are. So the Celts were a mixture of different peoples, right? So maybe, different physical features, different color skin, but one thing that they had in common is that they all spoke what are now known as the Celtic languages. So they all spoke different dialects that were closely related to one another. So even though the Celts occupied and they controlled a large part of Western Europe, including Britain and Ireland around the time of Julius Caesar, they wouldn't have been part of the same empire. They didn't have the same emperor or king or anything like that. They would have been small, kind of politically independent tribal peoples, let's say. So it was the language that united them. Now, why was I talking about Julius Caesar and the Celts and the Gaels? Well, the reason why it's interesting and why I brought it up is that Julius Caesar, in his book Commentarii, he talks about a sport that he saw being played by the Celts in Gaul or in Gallia, right, in modern-day France. And it was a ball that, when he describes it, it sounds very, very like hurling. Okay, so you have a stick and a ball, and it's kind of like soccer, but instead of just scoring goals, you can hit the ball or the slitter over the bar and you can score points. So if you hit the slitter over the bar and score a point, then you get one sort of third of a goal. So if you score 3 points, then that equals to one goal, if you like, right? I'm going to show you as well the story of a person called Cú Chulainn and how he got his name, because in Cú Chulainn's story, his interest in hurling is mentioned, right? So there's lots of stories about this historical hero, Cú Chulainn. And according to these stories, he was a great hurler, right? So these stories, so this is a picture here of Cú Chulainn that you can see on the slide. Okay, now, so Cú Chulainn is kind of this mythological figure in Irish history. So he's not a real figure. He's a legendary figure. Cú Chulainn was half human and then half a god, so half a deity. So he was the product of a relation between a human mother and then a god, an ancient Celtic god. So the name of his father, the god, was Lugh, Lugh. Now, this god, Lugh, was not just worshipped in Ireland, but he was worshipped throughout Western Europe. For example, the city of Lyon in modern-day France was named after him. Also, the city of Leon in Spain was also named after Lugh. And the Roman word for the province, which is now occupied by the modern-day countries of Portugal and Galicia in northwestern Spain, that was known as Lusitania by the Romans. And so the Lu again comes from the god's name, Lu. Lugh. So there's also a county in Ireland called County Louth. In Irish, that county is Cumbeilu, right? So that county, 32 counties in Ireland, one of them, Lugh, is named after the god. And also how you say August, the month of August in Irish, is Lunasa. Okay, Lunasa. So Lunasa is a festival that kind of took place on the 1st of August and marked the start of the harvest period. Okay, and Lugh was associated with the harvest. That was his sort of role as a god. Okay, so anyway, his son was Cú Chulainn. Now, Cú Chulainn, he wasn't always called Cú Chulainn, this hero, right? He started off his life and his name was Setanta. So Setanta was Cú Chulainn's name when he was a child. So one day, a blacksmith by the name of Cullen organized a great feast. Setanta got an invitation to go to this feast or go to this party. So he was out with his friends playing hurling and he lost track of time. So Setanta ended up arriving late to the party. So when he arrived at the location of the party in Cullen's fort, or Cullen's fort is a protected dwelling place, F-O-R-T. So when he arrived there, he arrived late, and Cullen had a guard dog, a big, fierce guard dog who was protecting the entrance to the fort. And the guard dog was, you know, extremely large and vicious, and it attacked Setanta. So Setanta, he didn't have any weapons. And of course, he was just a child at this time. You know, he was like 12 years old or something like that. So he didn't have any weapons to protect himself from this guard dog. So, however, he did have a hurley and slitter with him. So he had the stick and he had the ball. So he hit the slitter with the hurley and it went straight down the dog's throat and it killed the dog instantly, broke its jaw, and the animal fell dead on the ground. So as you can imagine, Cullen was not very happy at all with this. So, you know, he sort of said, look, who will guard my fort now that you've killed my prized guard dog? So Setanta decided to say, look, I'll be your guard. I'll be your guard in the meantime until you find a dog as great as the one that you just killed. So he did so. He became the bodyguard of Cullen's fort. And that's where he got the name Cú Chulainn from. In Irish, translated into English, it means Cú is dog or hound. And Chulainn is the genitive or the possessive form of the name Cullen. Okay, so he is the hound of Cullen, or the hound of Ulster, as he's sometimes called. That was the name of the province and the historical kingdom in the north of Ireland where Cú Chulainn was from. So he became the guard dog from that day forward until he was, a young man. And that's how he started his life. So you can see, right, that, you know, this story, it was written down first in Gaelic or in the Irish language, about 1,000th of the Common Era, approximately. But the story itself existed for at least a few hundred years before that. So it would have been passed on from generation to generation through the word of mouth. So this gives you another sort of sense of how ancient this game of hurling was. So it's very, very old indeed, going back into the mists of time. So here's an artist's depiction of Cú Chulainn. He's got a slitter in his left hand and he's got a hurley that he's just about to swing to hit the slitter. And you see the dog, the guard dog, just outside Cullen's fort, just about to attack him. So this story has never been put on film. You know, I think it would make a great movie. So maybe one day, I mean, there's talk like that there at the moment that they're producing a film version of the story of Cú Chulainn. I think that would be amazing if they did that. Let's see though. But anyway, this story is also told to children in Ireland when they're very small, you know. So I remember hearing this story when I was like maybe 6 or 7 in school and being fascinated by Cú Chulainn and thinking about his life. And there are many other stories connected with him. So maybe you might be interested in finding out a little bit more about him. But I mention him today just to show you the antiquity of the game of hurling, let's say. So going back to kind of more modern times, right? So towards the end of the 19th century in Ireland, Ireland, of course, was part of the United Kingdom, and it was being governed from Westminster in London. And the British cultural influence over Ireland was becoming greater as the century went on. So British sports, right, that were developed and codified around this time, such as rugby union, association football, and cricket, these games were becoming increasingly popular in Ireland. So especially following the codification of these sports. Now, by codification, I mean that the rule books were being written up for the sports. So like towards the middle of the 19th century, those sports were being formalized. The rules were being agreed upon. For example, in association football, the size of the goal was being decided. You know, how many meters apart should the post be? How high should the bar be? How big should the playing surface be for association football and for rugby and for cricket? So they were all being formalized. They were being, you know, semi-professionalized. You know, they were starting to wear kind of uniforms of the same color to denote that they were on the same team. So these sports, because they were being codified, they started to become more competitive as well, because you can't have kind of national competitions or even international competitions, especially unless players agree upon a set of rules. Okay, so you have to have a set of rules that everybody knows about first before you can organize competitions, right? They started to take over, and people who were like athletically minded, you know, they tended to kind of go for the British sports that were being played in Ireland because they were being played to a higher level, a more competitive level. So the Irish sports were still popular, but they were being played at a local level, and they'd yet to be codified, so they'd yet to be formalized in terms of their rules. So it meant that, you know, each parish, so each small little community in Ireland would play against the parishes, would play hurling and Gaelic football against the local parishes, maybe the parish next door or other ones nearby. But they wouldn't be playing against teams from other parts of the county, not to mention other parts of Ireland. Okay, so that was kind of holding the Gaelic games back. So under the influence of this, and with the increasing denomination of the British sports in Ireland, what we consider the British sports in Ireland to be, association football, cricket, and rugby union, there was it was seen that there was a need to create a society or an association to codify and to formalize the rules of the Gaelic games. So this is what happened. Right. So in 1884, the Gaelic Athletic Association was established on the 1st of November in Hayes Hotel in Tipperary. And it was set up to promote and encourage people to play the native sports of Gaelic football and hurling. So let's have a look anyway, a quick look at the two sports, right? I'm going to send you, first of all, this link, right? It's a link to YouTube. And this will show you the game of hurling. So let me just send that to you now. And we'll take a small little break and I'll give you a chance to take a look at that. I'll send it to you on the chat here, all right, on Zoom. Okay, so it's only about 3 minutes long. All right, so just take a moment anyway to take a look at that link. And then I'll send you the link for Gaelic football after a minute. Okay. Hello, Harua. How are you?
Hello.
My name is Rob. I just sent you a link about, you can see it there in the chat. So maybe you can take a look at that. So we're talking about this morning, Gaelic games, the native games of Ireland, hurling and Gaelic football. So I just sent you this video, first of all, to take a look at hurling. And I'm going to send you another video in a second, which will show you Gaelic football. Then the British turned up then at the stadium, right, at Croke Park. Now, the reason that they went to Croke Park was that they suspected that the supporters from the match, some of them had come up from Tipperary and some of them were the ones who had carried out these assassinations. So the match was between Tipperary and Dublin. So they suspected, you know, the supporters from Tipperary had come up and that they were the ones who had committed the murder. So they went over to Croke Park, you know, to ostensibly on a search mission just to see, like, if they could find any weapons amongst the supporters. But this is what actually happened on the day. So this will take you to YouTube. Okay, so you can see here, right? So this is the game that's going on between Tipperary and Dublin on that day on the 21st of November 1920. So the game had just started, and then the British soldiers arrived, the British military forces arrived into Croke Park. Okay, so there's lots of people watching the match and enjoying the match. It was only a few minutes on. So the British forces, they broke into the stadium with armored cars. They The crowd, of course, weren't sure what they were going to do at first, but, you know, people had heard that there was, you know, a strike by the IRA on the British intelligence services that morning. So they thought that there could be an act of revenge. But you can see there that the player kind of is playing on. Okay. And then he gets shot. And then the British go on to start firing at the crowd, and 12 people were murdered on that day by the British, including 3 children. So one 10-year-old child, one 11-year-old child, and another 14-year-old child. And 60 people were injured on that day. None of the British forces were injured. So that event, when that happened, so it was known as Bloody Sunday. So just last Saturday, the 21st of November, 2020, this year was the 100-year anniversary of Bloody Sunday. So you can see that the event of Bloody Sunday, it happened in Dublin, but it was reported all over the world. This newspaper, the Daily World, is from Vancouver. Okay, you can see Vancouver there. So it made front page news all over the world. And it also damaged British reputation, not just in Ireland, but in places like Canada and the United States, and also in countries like France and Germany and places like that as well. So it damaged British prestige and reputation. And yeah, so it says 26 dead. It was actually 14 in Croke Park. And then there had been 12 members of the British intelligence services who were shot by the Irish Republican Army during the very early morning. So it was a shocking event, and it will be forever remembered, I think, in the history of the GAA as, you know, one of the most notorious events to happen. Now, one of the stands, one of the parts, the stands of Croke Park is named after the footballer from Tipperary who was murdered by the British on that day. His name was Michael Hogan. So one of the stands is called the Hogan Stand in Croke Park. So in memory of his life that was cruelly taken away from him. So that happened in 1920. In 1974, the Ladies Gaelic Football Association is established in Thurles in County Tipperary. So Tipperary, this is a picture of them, and they were the winners of the first ever football championship in 1974. So you can find out a little bit more about what Gaelic football was like in the 1980s. Excuse me, if you take a look at that link there, right, it takes you to the RTE archives, but we won't look at that now. But I'll just show you briefly, like, where we'll take you to. Okay, and this one is in English. Okay, so we'll take you on to this part here. So it just explains, you know, about Gaelic football. It was seen up until that time to be a sport that was just for men rather than for women. Now women were playing camogie since the early 20th century, but they hadn't been playing football. So that was kind of an important progression, I suppose, at the moment when women started playing Gaelic football. Okay, so just going back to our slideshow. So the All-Ireland final is played every year in hurling and football in Croke Park. It's normally played in September. However, this year, because of COVID-19, it's going to be played next month in December. The 16th of December, I believe, is the date when the finals will start. So the All-Ireland has only ever been played outside of Ireland once. And this was when it was played in New York City in the year 1946 or 1947, sorry. So here are some pictures, right, of the hurling final being played. And actually, this is from the football final. It's being played in Giant Stadium in New York City. So you can get an idea of how many people were there at the match as well in New York, you know. And it was a very big deal as well to have the All-Ireland played in New York City at the time. So it's in the same place where the Giants, New York Giants, play their matches. So there was also a foreign sports ban up until 1971. It was forbidden for any member of the GAA to play one of the foreign sports. So by foreign sports, they mean rugby, rugby association football and cricket. There was also, this should be rule, R-U-L-E. There was also a rule 42, which meant that foreign sports couldn't be played on GAA grounds. And this rule was revoked in the year 2005. Okay, so in 1993, there was a plan to revamp Croke Park. And it was finally finished then in 2002. It was opened up ahead of time. So it's now the third largest stadium in Europe, and I think one of the largest, 10 largest in the world, with a capacity of 8,300. This is the Hogan Stand over here. And you can see that there is one of the older stands to get an idea of what Croke Park would have looked like when it originally started. You know, it's quite small. That stand at the opposite side of the stadium is known as Hill 16. And it's called 16 because it refers to 1916. To the Easter Rising of 1916, and the rubble from the buildings that were destroyed by the British in 1916 were used to build that stand. Okay, so that's where the name Hill 16 comes from. So anyway, that's the stadium. Now, in 2005, the GAA were allowed to play soccer and rugby matches for the first ever time in Croke Park. So when they got rid of Rule 42, this was only for a temporary basis. Now, the reason that they had to find another place to play rugby and association football was that the Aviva Stadium, or what used to be known as Lansdowne Road, was being redeveloped, and it was being, you know, the capacity was being increased. So they needed, you know, temporary grounds that were large enough to hold, you know, like huge crowds that would be needed, you know, for rugby. So anyway, this is a painting from the first ever, you know, foreign sport that was played in Croke Park. And that was the match between England and Ireland in rugby in 2007. Now, because the English forces, you know, had committed that act of violence in Croke Park in 1920, it was a very big event that, you know, 85 years after Bloody Sunday, that rugby was played in the stadium. And also the English national anthem, God Save the Queen, was sung in the stadium. Now, people were worried when this happened, when this rugby match happened, they were worried that the crowd would start booing for God Save the Queen. And that people wouldn't accept that the British national anthem was being sung in the stadium where they had committed that heinous act of violence. The crowd remained respectfully quiet, and in the end, it was a great day. So I'm going to show you some pictures from the anthems being sung at the start of that match. And I want you to try to notice the passion on people's faces, on the players' faces and on the members of the crowd's faces when the national anthems are being played. So let me just take you to that.
Eyes over North Dublin.
Ladies and gentlemen,
okay, so first of all, they play God Save the King. And they're the English rugby players singing the national anthem. And the crowd, the Irish crowd, are kind of remaining respectfully quiet. You can see that they're not singing that, and they're not booing or anything like that. They're very emotionally charged. And then they got a round of applause as well from the supporters, which again is a very important symbolic move. And now Alron, the Irish national anthem, has been played. Look at the passion and emotion on the players' faces, you know. Of course, any match between England and Ireland, you know, the rivalry is always incredible. But the historical significance of this match in particular was very, very important. Okay, so that was just a taster of that event in 2007 in Croke Park. So that was one of the historical events in the stadium. And it marked kind of a return to normal, or a normalization of relations between Britain and Ireland, because, you know, there had been a conflict, a war in Northern Ireland as well, which ended in 1998. So 2007, 9 years afterwards, the English team were able to play that game in Croke Park. So it was seen as a very important act of reconciliation between the two countries. So looking at Gaelic games today, so you have now over 2,200 clubs all around the country. There are 400 clubs abroad, including some clubs in Japan, as I was talking about. There are 500 camogie clubs and 1,000 women's Gaelic football clubs. So Croke Park is one of the biggest stadiums in the world. The same cannot be said for the other GAA sports. So like rounders and handball, you know, they're only played by a minority of people today. Okay, we leave these true and false questions, because I want to go on to another topic, right? So I'll just share the next slide with you there. Does anybody have any questions about this point, at this point, about what we've seen so far? Remember, guys, I know there's a lot of information and maybe I'm kind of talking too fast, but I will send you a recording of this presentation and you can go back over it, and you can hopefully maybe be able to understand a little bit more. So I'm going to talk about the Gaelic League just briefly, right, to tell you about that, because in 1892, Douglas Hyde, who was to become the first president of the Republic of Ireland when we got independence from the British. He gave a lecture entitled The Necessity of De-Anglicising the Irish People. He said that if Irish disappeared, then the Irish would not be entitled, to claim to be a nation. So, there was movements towards nationalism all across Europe during the latter half of the 19th century. And in the same way, that the Danish have their own language, the Swedish have their own language, the Polish have Polish, the country of Hungary has Hungarian. So there was a strong connection between having a language and having a nation. So the speakers of the same language were seen as, being part of the same nation. So Ireland, was increasingly speaking English at this time. So that's why Douglas Hyde made that speech. Anyway, in order to stop the arrest of Irish, you can see actually in when I show you here in the next slide, right? I'll just increase the size of this there for a second, right? You can see the situation, first of all, of Irish. This is in 1844. And you can see as the century goes on, you can see how the language starts to get weaker and weaker and weaker and get more and more isolated towards the western part of the country. Actually, that video isn't very good, so I'm going to take you to another one here. Okay, this will show you it hopefully in a bit more detail. One second there now, let's just stop sharing. Okay, so you can see as the 19th century gradually goes on, the Irish language is being eroded and being pushed into the West. So let's play the video. So you can see that the famine, really was a death blow for the Irish language. It starts to become more and more isolated into the west of the country around this time. So in 1740, practically the whole country, except for the northeastern part and Dublin and its suburbs and County Wexford. But then as the 19th century kind of goes on, you get, to 1845, let's say this is on the eve of the Great Famine in 1844. So, you can see at that stage, the vast majority of people in Ireland spoke Irish, spoke the Gaelic language. And then, as the famine continues, you have 1 million people dying and another 1.5 million people emigrating between the years of 1845 to 1852. Most of the people who died were Irish speakers. In fact, probably about 95% of them were native Irish speakers. And a similar, well, not maybe that high a percentage, but probably 60 to 70% of the Irish who emigrated to places like the United States, Canada, Australia, during the famine and so between 1845 and 1852, about 60, 70% of them were Irish speakers. So you can see how that kind of kills off. There were 4 million Irish speakers in 1845 in Ireland. By 1852, there's a little bit more than, 1.5 million. So that kind of devastates the numbers of people speaking the language. So you can see as we move on, during the century, particularly during the famine, you know, it's devastating. And by the end of the famine, you know, the language has been reduced to isolated areas in the south and west. So you can see, like, when we get into the 20th century or 1920, you know, the language has been isolated to, you know, very remote western regions where it's still spoken today. So there was a raising of consciousness about this and about the need to stop this effect. So only 14% of the country were speaking Irish in 1891. Now, why did the decline happen? Well, the decline in the Irish language happened, first of all, due to the low status of Irish. Most people who spoke it were poor and uneducated. Powerful figures such as landlords, judges, and politicians spoke English. And English was seen as more useful for emigration, going to the United States or Canada or Australia, places like that, Britain. So parents wanted their schools to teach it to their children and not Irish. And also very few Irish speakers could read and write Irish. This is because the national schools, which had been set up in 1839, they were forbidden to teach the language. And then, you know, when they were starting in 1839, you know, the majority of people in the country spoke Irish. So a lot of people were going to school and they couldn't understand the language that was being spoken by the teacher, English. All of the newspapers and all of the books that were available in Ireland at the time, even in the Irish-speaking regions, were all in English. And if you learned how to read and write in Ireland, even if your native language was Irish, you learned to read and write in English. So anyway, that gives you a sense of what happened with the Irish language. So anyway, this new interest in Irish was started by people like Douglas Hyde, who, as I was saying, became the first president of Ireland. So a new interest in Irish appeared in the 1880s and 1890s. One of the reasons was that there was a renewed interest amongst linguistic scholars from Europe, especially from Germany, people like the Grimm brothers, who were also folklorists and collected, you know, the fairy tales that their names are associated with. So anyway, they came over to Ireland, these linguists, because, you know, Irish is one of the oldest written European languages. So they had, you know, great curiosity about it because, you know, they wanted to compare, for example, the Irish language with other European languages to try to find if they were from a common source, if they were related anyway. They were also comparing the folklore from Ireland with the folklore from places like Germany and Sweden, again, to try to trace it back and see if this folklore had come from a common source. And then this started a renewed interest in Irish. And then people like Douglas Hyde, you know, they went around the country collecting things like songs. So this is a book that he published. So he went around and he collected the songs in Irish and then he translated them into English so that people in the English-speaking east of the country could have access to these as well. So that was published in the 1880s, I believe. And so this is a quotation from Douglas Hyde. The Gaelic League is founded not upon hatred of England, but upon love of Ireland. Hatred is a negative passion. It is powerful, a very powerful destroyer, but is useless for building up. Love, on the other hand, is like faith. It can move mountains. And faith, we have mountains to move. So then also what happened around this time is the Irish literary revival. Now, I will leave you read about this in your own time. I will pass you this slide. And you can also read the biographies of Douglas Hyde and William Butler Yeats. But the Gaelic literary revival stemmed from the revival in interest in Irish. So Yeats himself became a member of Douglas Hyde's Irish or the Gaelic League. He didn't manage to learn Irish, but he did become greatly influenced by works that were being translated by people like Hyde and others from Irish into English, be they songs, poems, stories. And it was this new kind of literature that was coming from Gaelic myth that inspired Yeats to write some of his poetry and some of his literary plays, such as Kathleen Ni Chulainn. So this was a famous play that was staged in the Abbey Theatre in Dublin. Also around this time, another writer who was a contemporary and a friend of Yeats, who was greatly influenced by Yeats, wrote the book The Playboy of the Western World, which was based on life of Irish native speakers in Inishmore on the Aran Islands off the coast of Galway. So anyway, you can read about this in your own time. As I said, I'll pass you the slide. There's also some other links on these slides so that you can find out a little bit more about the GAA. So that is the end of the presentation. So we're going to take a little bit of a break now for a couple of minutes. And when we come back, I'll give you a chance to ask some questions. And we're also going to look at a little bit of pronunciation. Okay, so we'll take a break of about maybe 5 minutes or so now. Okay.